Hello and welcome to this recording of EG's Future of London session on the future of work and how real estate can help solve the UK's productivity problem. You're about to hear an interview between me, Emily Wright, tech editor and head of special projects at EG, and Dror Polleg, author of Rethinking Real Estate and a regular contributor to EG's tech pages. Dror called in from New York for this discussion, where he reveals why he thinks London is in a particularly strong position compared to some other global cities when it comes to weathering the COVID-19 storm.
Hello and welcome to EG's Future of London event hosted together with LREF. I'm Emily Wright, tech editor and head of special projects at EG. And today we will be addressing one of the six challenges facing the capital as part of the wider Future of London series taking place throughout the month of October. For today's challenge, I'm delighted to be joined by the legendary Dror Polleg. I don't say that lightly, legendary, author of Rethinking Real Estate and the co-chair of the Urban Land Institute's Technology and Innovation Council in New York. For what will be one of our keynote interviews, for the discussion around how real estate can help solve the UK's productivity problem, with the future of work looking different in many ways to how it did at the start of the year. Now, Dror, people will have noticed there from your job description that you are actually, you are New York based, presumably still New York based for now. But as a leading commentator on all things global cities, trends and the future, whether that be the way we work, the way we live, the way we play, I know that you are perfectly positioned to comment on this subject and really appreciate you joining us here today. So I'm always a bit reticent at this stage of the game to lead on the pandemic, but I'm going to, because I think in this particular instance, it has been just such an important milestone when we're looking at the way we work and we're looking at productivity. So how, from what you can see in across global cities, and obviously focusing, you know, on London as well, how far has it either held us back or pushed us forward in terms of city function, workspace, and productivity?
Wow, big question. So first, great to be here with you and with everyone. And as you mentioned, I'm based in New York, but I've lived in London before. I've lived in Paris, I've lived in Beijing, I've lived in Melbourne, Australia. So I have a good sense of, you know, how big cities work and what's nice about them and what doesn't work too well. In terms of the pandemic, I would definitely say it pushed us forward. I mean, it expedited a lot of things that were already in place, which is good news for some parts of cities and then more challenging news for other parts. And I think it also reset a lot of our kind of daily lives in a sense that forces us to really rethink how we do things. A lot of stuff that we took for granted and we didn't even notice that we're doing, and a lot of choices we just assume to be, you know, just the way the world works, we suddenly realize that, you know, that we have an explicit choice. So since we are, you know, we are speaking in the context of real estate, I actually think that what's happening to cities now or what will happen to them over the next 2 years is very similar to what started to happen in real estate and in office, in particular over the last 5 years, which is the realization that your customers, in this case, your residents or citizens, have a choice. Which doesn't mean that they're all going to leave. It doesn't mean that, you know, they don't want to be where they are, but it means that you suddenly have to be mindful of them being really consumers of something, and that very easily they can shift to other alternatives. And shifting to other alternatives might mean, okay, we're going to leave the city altogether, but probably more interestingly, it can just mean, okay, I'm just going to spend more time in this part of the city rather than go to the other part that I used to go to all the time, or I'm going to go there a little less. Or I'm going to shift some of the activities that I do between different parts of the city. So the interesting question, and I assume we'll dive a little more into the details, so I'm just talking at a high level, is less about, you know, cities good, cities bad, or, you know, the death of cities or the life of cities. It's more about how are things going to get kind of reshuffled within cities. And then, of course, yes, there are opportunities for other cities or, you know, even non-urban areas. But I think these are more kind of marginal. I think the most interesting question is what happens within cities. And I think the cities that will thrive over the next 10 years are those that are able to adjust fast enough and to allow people to kind of live the life that they want within the city without having to leave.
And that's opened up sort of the way for a really good follow-up question on that. And it's another big question. But you said that the cities that thrive will be the ones that can adjust and adapt to suit the changing needs of what people want and this changing demand. How do cities do that, particularly big cities, where you have these huge, you know, sprawling areas and, you know, if not in, you know, distance and size, then in terms of population and density? How does a city make that happen? And we're talking here particularly about the big cities, about London, of course, this is future of London, and also New York. And, you know, it's quite a difficult thing to address on a large scale.
So, you know, when we look at the history of London, we see that first, some areas that are currently integral parts of the city, maybe 150 years ago, were considered suburbs and faraway places and, you know, not very dense. But the city allowed them to become more dense. It expanded its infrastructure to accommodate them. So it is possible. I think even in terms of the center of the city, the opposite thing occurred. So, you know, places like Lombard Street or places in the city of London used to be residential areas for, you know, for a couple hundred years at least, since they kind of became important. And the people who lived in them actually worked from home. You know, the bankers and the merchants, they had a little office downstairs or upstairs, and the family and the horses and everything else was there as well. And they managed to adjust and become purely commercial buildings and larger buildings as well, and kind of built all sorts of things around them in order to accommodate the previous paradigm of a more industrial world where, you know, everyone had to come and be together at the same place at the same time in order to manufacture stuff. And then the office of the 20th century was kind of an evolution of that. So kind of like the Fordist or Taylorist idea of manufacturing, a lot of the same ideas came to the service world, and offices ended up being like factories for white collar workers. So just in terms of general hope, it's not hard to imagine that London can do it, because it's done it before a few different times. In terms of what it means in practice, it mostly means doubling down on things that are already in place and that are already working. So London already has a few different centers. I think trying to empower each of them to become more of a village, which doesn't mean cutting them off of, you know, the rest of the city. But again, if somebody lives in the west part of the city, they don't need to travel to Canary Wharf every day just in order to go to the office. Maybe they can go somewhere a little closer. So again, allowing, in terms of planning and building, the emergence of more kind of intermediate office spaces. I think part of the good news about COVID is that it's bringing down the value of all sorts of assets that probably would have taken a longer time to clear in terms of the pricing. So particularly retail, but even some other buildings, that suddenly do have buildings to work with closer to people's homes, and you can convert them into something that is a little more suitable for what they need. So if they need a place to work, not, again, not replacing their HQ, but kind of a temporary thing or something that they can use a few hours a day or a few days a week, you can create that. I think in terms of the infrastructure, to create more infrastructure that allows people to take advantage of things that are, you know, walkable and bicycleable. So both in terms of creating paths and changing the priorities of, you know, how roads are designed, in allowing, you know, something we saw in New York, and I think to a lesser extent in London, you know, allowing more outdoor dining, allowing different uses of this street in terms of the priorities of the city. You know, cities today, just thinking about cars, they have probably half of all the land is just used by cars, and it's something that we take for granted. But once you start taking some of that back, you suddenly have a lot of land that you can play with for all sorts of other uses. And I think people don't need that much, you know, just creating a little more space for them to do whatever they want with and to walk around safely and to play with their kids or to hang out with their friends already makes a huge difference. And on that note, I think London and other European cities are already at a huge advantage compared to, you know, American cities or even some of the large Asian cities. London is already very, very walkable. London is already built at a scale that is generally very human and very comfortable. You know, it's not, it doesn't have huge wide roads that people have to cross too often. So I think London has what it takes in place. And it basically means doubling down on the things that made it wonderful to begin with and deprioritizing office buildings as the kind of focal point of a city, which doesn't mean that, you know, people will not need offices, but I think over the last 70 years, maybe 100 years, we overemphasize offices in urban planning. You know, offices are at the center, they dominate the skyline, they define what the city looks like. I think that we can move back to, you know, prioritizing other uses. And ultimately, the future of office depends on the future of housing. It depends on people actually being able to live affordably closer to offices that they can walk to or that they can access easily, and being able to access the opportunities and the joys that the city offers, because otherwise, again, they have a choice. And if the trade-offs don't make sense, they can actually go somewhere else. They don't have to be in the city anymore in order to work, but they would love to do that if it's affordable and, of course, safe and pleasant and healthy.
Thank you very much. Great answer there. And I've got a couple of follow-up questions off the back of that. The first one is, obviously, this session is looking at how real estate can really address this productivity issue and the change of work. And I want to get on to, in the second part of this question, that the uncertainty around that, because at the moment there is still uncertainty, I think, as to, you know, it's no doubt that it's going to be led by demand and trends, but nobody's quite sure what those demand and trends are going to be just yet, I don't think. But before we get to that, you know, there was a point there that you made about, you know, one of the positives of this being that, you know, sort of costs have come down. And yeah, I suppose it depends on who you are and what you own and what you're invested in as to how much you would see that as a positive. So when we're looking at sort of the big real estate companies, the companies that have, you know, built up their name and their industry over the last, you know, several decades, by focusing on these huge office buildings and these HQs, how can they be involved in a way which is positive going forward in this change? Because it's such a huge mindset shift, of course, and one that would, you know, if that's the direction things go in, it would be foolish to ignore it. But, you know, how do they kind of, you know, look to those slightly less, you know, shiny central London HQ type office buildings?
So a few things. I think one, that's the bad news. I think that the destiny of office real estate is no longer in its own hands. I don't think that it's just about, you know, whatever we will do will be fine and we'll just worry about our own product. I think that these companies, and in the UK, I think the leading companies have already been working very hard to make buildings more sustainable and to create mixed use projects and to, you know, address all sorts of social issues, I think in great ways, probably better than their American counterparts and, you know, definitely better than other parts of the world. But I return again to the issue of housing and to the kind of urban vibe in general and the priorities of the city itself in terms of how it allocates land, particularly the, you know, cars versus walking and bicycles. I think that in order to really create wonderful areas, those developers will have to get more involved at the city level, or on the other hand, to develop even bigger projects that allow them to really reframe the landscape around them, a bit like what we saw in King's Cross, you know, where you can actually recreate a whole area that is really fun and vibrant because you're not thinking just like a building, you're thinking like a neighborhood or even beyond the neighborhood, and you're creating like a total experience that makes sense and is fun for people. But of course, that means taking more risk, thinking longer term, getting a little bit out of your comfort zone. I think within the buildings, a lot of things can change. So, you know, we need added stability. We need to address people's other daily needs. And we're seeing some of that beginning, you know, whether it's childcare or health or even an opportunity to take a nap or to, you know, stroll in nature or, you know, pet a little goat even. Like, you know, people are bringing different things to those areas to give people exposure to something that that they were missing in the office before. And also, maybe just repurposing some assets or parts of assets into other uses. I mean, I think when I look at office, I see three big challenges. I mean, one, probably softening of demand in total. Then even the demand that remains is probably distributed a little differently. So it's not all going to the same old locations, but again, some of it kind of goes to the periphery, goes closer to people's homes. And third, even the people who will travel to those central business districts will expect to find something a little different over there. So something that is more service, more flexible as a basis, but more importantly, going back to that important word choice, something that resonates with them personally, something that aligns with their values, something that makes them feel like they're part of something that is a little bigger. And of course, something that empowers whatever it is that they're trying to achieve. So if they just want to sit next to a computer and have access to internet, we already know that they don't need to go to the office for that. But jumping on that bandwagon of saying, oh, people will just come to socialize, you know, that's not the only thing either. Some people actually will come to do focused work or to use specialized equipment or to do all sorts of other things. And maybe the short and best answer is that there is no single answer. So if office was all about just being this boring, uniform thing that everyone kind of does the same, some people do it a little faster or a little cheaper and then they win, it's moving towards a product category, which is more about, you know, people doing completely different things and trying to figure out what works and what doesn't work, just like in any other consumer market, and a little closer to home, just like in the hotel world or the retail world, where, you know, everyone can tell you how to build a hotel, but still, some people do it really well, some people don't do it too well. It's about how you position it and, you know, the actual, you know, the touch and feel of the product and the meaning of the brand.
Thank you very much. We have a couple of minutes left. It's, you know, a short time frame to discuss something so wide reaching. So in a couple of minutes, I'm going to challenge you here. I've got two final sort of questions and points. Mm-hmm. The first one I mentioned earlier, you know, I'm not sure it's as simple at the moment as someone saying, oh, I'm more productive at home or I'm more productive in the office. People are still working it out. I think people sort of swing between the two. As you were saying, it very much depends on what it is that they're going to the office for. So how do you see real estate handling that uncertainty where, you know, at the moment we're still not sure what the future of work is going to look like? So that's the first bit. And then the second bit, again, very quickly if you can, is how likely do you think it is that we're going to see this mass exodus from global cities that people seem to be sort of very, you know, upset and about at the moment? I mean, I have my personal opinions on that. I'm not the expert. So those two questions, please.
So one, I would say embrace the risk. You know, don't try to ignore the risk. Don't try to pretend that whatever you were doing before is going to work. Actually push yourself to do things that are bolder. Again, more flexibility, more service, more experiments. Partner with a few different types of companies to try to see what works and what doesn't work. I think trying to stay safe at the moment is the riskiest strategy of all. Second, the general thought of, you know, the home or the office, to me, one of the biggest components in terms, you know, the biggest trouble of the office is not the office itself, it's the commute. So if you make it easier for me to come to the office, if you don't require me to spend 2 hours a day anymore going back and forth, I think that's a huge advantage. And I think companies should think about that, about the full customer journey, not just about if I change something in my building, will it make it, you know, a winner or a loser, but kind of try to think, okay, how can I make it easier for people to come to me, or where do I need to move in order to be relevant for them? As to the questions of a mass exodus, I think that there's a risk of that in a bunch of cities. I actually think that for London specifically, it has enough going for it that it can actually do relatively well. I think parts of it will be challenged. You know, when I look at a place like Canary Wharf, probably it's not the most fun place in the world. And if I have to commute there, I can say I don't really feel like it. But I think a lot of other parts of London are very pleasant, very walkable. They have fun retail. They have culture. I think the city has been trying hard to address cycling and other things. And developers as well made it easier, you know, they created showers and gyms and other amenities to kind of fit into people's lifestyles. So I think I would just try to double down on that. And I like for London, I'm generally optimistic. It doesn't mean that it's not going to be pain, like a huge exodus out of London. I do see bigger challenges for New York or San Francisco, but we don't need to worry about that today, I guess.
Well, Jo, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your thoughts on what is such a huge topic. And we had to do it in a short space of time, but I think we got some really great points across. Thank you for joining us, particularly all the way from New York. And to all of our viewers, please stick around and join us for the panel discussion next, where we'll be delving into some of the points that Jo made in more detail. Thank you. So we've heard from Draw, and now it's time to go to our panel to delve further into some of his thoughts on this particular challenge as part of our Future of London series. A reminder that we're considering the challenge that with the future of work looking very different to its past, how can real estate help to solve the UK's productivity problem? And we're going to be looking at London specifically, of course. So joining me now on an extremely esteemed panel, we have Piers Nichols, Head of Leasing, Brent Cross Town, Argent Related, Chipti Arya, Founder and CEO of Travtus, and Stephen Skinner, UK CEO of HB Rebus. So a brilliant cross-section there, and I'm sure it's going to be a wonderful opportunity to really delve into some of the things that Jo has already said. We don't have much time, so I'm going to get straight to it, if that's okay, as we have a lot to get through. So the first question that I wanted to ask was around Dror's comment that he believes that London in particular might fare really rather well off the back of what we're going through compared to some other cities. Of course, it's all based on comparables here. I mean, everybody's having a challenging time. So compared to some other European and US cities, and he mentioned New York, he says that he feels that London has all of the tools to really come out of this in a very strong position. So I just wanted to know how everybody else thought about that, what kind of evidence people have seen to back that up or not. And Piers, let's start with you on that.
I think London, I think it's too early to tell, to be honest. At the minute, we're seeing 10-15% of the workforce actually going back into London CBD. So zone one of London is obviously seeing a real shortfall in the amount of workers coming into the workplace. If you compare that to Greater London and the Outer London suburbs, well, arguably they're booming. So I think we're in a position here where there is a tale of two sorts. And until we get a vaccine, I think we'll really only understand the where the prevailing trends and whether people actually do want to commute less and people do want a different type of lifestyle.
Thank you very much. It sounds very active where you are. Actually, you're obviously back in some kind of an office, which is great. Nice to hear some background noise there. Tripti, what are your thoughts on that same question?
Well, I think it's a tricky question, and I think listening to Dror's comments, he's coming at it from an urban planning perspective, really, which is London is set up as kind of small villages, and that's primarily due to the history of London. It's a city that's grown organically. It's not one that was, planned to be a city. It's something that started off with, a small city by the River of Thames, which has now become what we call Greater London. And it's gone from one zone to, say, zone five. And honestly, at this point, depending on how Crossrail works out and other infrastructure works out, the whole of England could end up being London. So I think what Dror did mention is interesting from an urban planning perspective, but I think where we are right now requires a little more thought beyond just the urban planning side. I think my bigger concern for cities is not whether people return to it, whether it's for work or for living. The bigger concern is how cities will sustain themselves. Because at this point, there's two things that they actually need to look at beyond just people commuting in. One is the revenues of a city. Because these cities are also, in a way, organizations which need to be run, their services to be provided, and those services have to be paid for. Currently, I don't know, and New York definitely has this problem, where you don't really know where the revenues to sustain these cities are coming from, because those taxes are not being collected from businesses, they're not being collected from services. And it does become a bit of a drain on resource of how you keep these cities to be flourishing organisms that they have. So I think there's definitely a financial perspective, which goes beyond the urban planning side, at least the physical urban planning side. There's the other aspect, which I think Dror mentioned, and that's about safety. And again, that kind of links back to what are people doing? What are the social elements within a city where people are actually functioning in closer quarters than they ever have before? And given the density of cities and given the nature of a pandemic, how does that actually mitigate from a social perspective? So I agree that it's a bit early for us to take a decision on cities. Do I think cities will survive? In general, yes. Is London better positioned than New York? Potentially because of the way that it's structured. It's a little more free, it's a little more outgrown, and honestly, it is fairly well connected in comparison to American cities, which are completely linked to people driving in or living in a drivable distance. So I think that I wouldn't jump the gun to say that London will perform better than New York. If you ask a hardcore New Yorker, they're going nowhere. There's a lot of people in New York who are taking a fantastic summer. They moved out because their lease ends in August. I think a lot of people don't recognize that when people graduate from universities in America, that's when they first time sign their lease in the city. And that usually is in the month of August. So there's a lot of leases that actually come in for renewal in August. People have taken the decision to temporarily leave and have a little hiatus in upstate New York. But I don't think the intention is to leave New York. The intention is to take a temporary break from paying high rent. We'll see if that turns into a permanent move. I think that's a bit premature.
Thank you very much. And I'm definitely going to come back to that point you made about cities having to be run like organizations and the revenue stream and the taxation. That's so interesting and something that we should definitely explore more later in this conversation. Thank you very much. And Stephen, what are your thoughts on London compared to other global cities?
I think people generally underestimate London, how good it is, especially if you start at the kind of the highest level, even in, especially in a national context. I'm not sure how many people are making a choice between London or New York, so how relevant that comparison will actually be. But if you just start at a high level, London, for as much as we like to moan about it, world-class transport infrastructure. We have 3 or 4 genuinely international airports. We have 5 or 6 huge train stations. We have a really brilliant tube network. The idea of for someone like me coming from Sheffield originally, that I can get on a tube any time of day, pretty much 24 hours, and there'll be a train there within minutes to take me to where I want to be. I think we underestimate that. I think London has relatively balanced global economy between professional services, financial services, and technology. We've seen significant kind of inner city regeneration of large parts of London. We've got world-class education, medical facilities and establishments. So I think London's well positioned to come out of this in a strong place.
Thank you very much. So a nice breadth of opinion there on that point, which is exactly what I was looking for. So thank you very much. We didn't even plan it, which is great. But I want to talk about a specific issue now before we move on to talk about the broader issues, which Tripti has kind of already alluded to in her answer to the first question. But the specific issue that I wanted to talk about is around the future of work and the impact that has on cities, and in this case, London. It's something that has been a topic for discussion among the industry and the wider world since the pandemic hit, really, and since everybody sort of left their offices. And then some people still haven't gone back, some people have, some people have gone back and then come back again because of all the changing restrictions and legislation. So it's a very complicated time for offices, and particularly offices in cities. Now, Stephen, I want to start with you on this. How far do you believe the way we work will change or not? Is it a question of an acceleration? Is it a question of a slowdown? And what do developers in cities need to do to keep up with all of this?
Good question. I think from my point of view, the biggest change when it comes to working, which then has an impact on workspace, is essentially, at the moment, working styles have become almost democratized. So, it's almost down to the individual level now, individual person to make a choice when they want to work, how they want to work, and also where they want to work. And I think our challenge is to figure out how we can best support those people with both kind of physical infrastructure, so some sort of place to work, and places to work can be anywhere now, right? It can be high quality housing, it can be office space, it could be co-working, it could be a park, it could really be anywhere. And so to give people the infrastructure to be able to be productive and really do their best work is important. And as I said, it's become democratized and it's very individual based on the individual's needs. So, you hear lots of people commenting at the moment about, the office will be used for a place of collaboration, building culture, meetings, etc. That might work for some people. And, I think I've mentioned this to you before. For me, I need the office for quiet space. I can't work at home. I have, from the hours of 6 a.m. until school, 3 children running around, and again from 3 o'clock until, they go to bed. I cannot function from home, even to do quiet work. So I need my workspace to be able to provide that for me as well. So like I said, I think it'll be led by the individual, and I think it's up to the employer to really understand what their employees need based on the job they do, and it's us, the real estate industry, to provide that infrastructure, whatever it may be.
Thank you very much. Tripti, can I come to you? Because that sort of leads into a question around, I mean, I think there was a, you know, Stephen really addressed that, you know, the role for developers, but how does this all work and fit in with the role of the city? You know, how does the city handle these changes, whatever they might be, and how does it impact on the cities? And in this case, obviously, because it's the future of London, specifically a city like London.
I think the whole concept of office space becoming consumer driven is quite interesting. And I think that's something that's new to at least the industry that we're used to, which where office space is usually considered an equivalent to a bond. You know, you're going to have a long term lease, you have an enterprise client. And I mean, exactly to the point that people have different ways of working. And in order to be more productive, and this is pre-coronavirus, even if we pull coronavirus completely out of the equation, we were already trending towards a world where there were studies that were telling you that people are more productive when you give them flexibility. Now, flexibility does not mean work from home. And I have a feeling that a lot of us are looking at the perspective of the future of work as individuals, and we're not looking at the perspective of a business. As a business, you actually need functioning teams, and you do need people being able to collaborate because they bring different ideas or thoughts, and those teams together then result in innovation or a product or a service that usually is kind of the alpha of that company. That's the reason why you do what you do so well. Now, the minute we start segregating people out of those teams, even if it's about video calls and coming together, it's not the same thing as the environment that's created, say, in a university campus. You have people with different backgrounds, different ideologies, having conversations where, you know, ideas are genesis of something happens. Cities are the same. There's a reason why cities are where you see all the intellectual capital kind of coming through, and you see manufacturing, et cetera, on the outsides. The reason for that is you have people with different backgrounds coming and having those conversations and kind of challenging each other, even when they don't realize it. Now, from a city's perspective, you want that to continue. Otherwise, if you really intend to create a productive environment or a productive economy, which is the biggest problem the UK right now is handling, you need to look at both the numerator and the denominator of that equation. And the numerator is actually the value add service that's being created. London had its highest peak in productivity after 2008. The reason for that is because financial services are a very high numerator, and that's what London represents. So it's not about the number of hours people are working, it's about the value that you're creating. But then on the flip side, we also have a lot of jobs in London, which are consumer-driven, retail, F&B, which actually are all about the denominator, about people being more efficient from an individual level. Now, I think as a city, you need to look at both, which means how do people function within a city? What represents a city? You almost need to redefine what does London mean? Because if your headquarters is, say, in London, and that becomes the pilgrimage that everybody makes in order to create the culture, does anyone who gets their economic benefit out of a London tax-paying organization does become a Londoner? Which means, does somebody sitting in Mumbai actually belong to London? And I think that's where it becomes really complex. And I think what we're really not gauging is, in order to do that, you're going to change the nature or the legal nature of the definition of an employee. And in the UK, you already have this. You have contractors and you have employees. And Uber kind of started this anyways, where people suddenly said, I need the independence or the freedom. I need the flexibility. But then they're giving up something in return. And we all need to make a conscious decision that we are willing to give up that social net that a typical employee would receive, because they have their loyalties attached to one company. And the culture of that company usually comes from that interaction. It's not about coming to a pool table in your office. It's about the people around you, the conversation you have. And I think a lot of that company culture then gets lost in kind of Teams meetings, but you're not really engaging the same way. So you'll end up with tiers of people. And that is concerning from the perspective of the city not knowing how to handle that, because the city no longer is physical.
Wow, that was quite the answer, Tripti. And I like the final sentence.
Sorry.
The city is no longer physical. I mean, that takes into a whole other topic for discussion. Piers, I mean, I don't know whether you have any thoughts on anything that Stephen and Tripti have said on that, or whether you just wanted to give your thoughts on this this kind of specific idea of the future of work, how it's changing, what that's going to mean for cities. Obviously, Argent has been incredibly active in, you know, developing and shaping London in a way that very few other businesses or companies in real estate have been able to do in recent times, due to the huge amount of space and that sort of longevity of development. So what are your thoughts on work, how it impacts cities, and what could be next?
Look, I think we're at an extraordinary time. I know with Brent Cross Town, we're building a new city for London and a new town for London. And it's really focused on purpose. So if you're a organization, whether an academic institution or a big business or a startup, we're creating an ecosystem at Brent Cross Town where companies can converge into one location, share data, share resources, and co-create services and for the future. So you're creating a place for organizations that have a real purpose to congregate, and also for staff and individuals. Brent Cross Town set around 50 acres of parkland, and on that we're putting amenities, indoor and outdoor facilities, where people can flourish, where people can be closer to nature and closer to health and well-being. And that's important for companies because hopefully it'll mean there's a higher performance of work. So really, I think it's about creating places that have real meaning and real purpose, both for companies to be there and for people to decide to come to work. And I think we're at this stage where people are really questioning and wanting a more sustainable form of transport. So people are looking to live and work in a closer location. And I think through the pandemic, people are now much more aware of their own health and well-being. And I think these are the kind of things that we could really, for the first time in 10 years, address our productivity problems.
And in terms of how much scope there is to continue to develop in this way due to space restrictions with so many cities and the fact that, you know, we are running out of, you know, big swathes of land on which to develop and to create these, as you've referred to it, a town within a city. You know, what's the future for this, for that sort of development, really? Is it finite? That's a question for you, Piers, as well.
There are only so many locations in city where you've got 180 acres of land. So that, yes, it is a kind of a unique opportunity. But ultimately, Stephen's right, London's reinvented itself. It's created from a historic series of boroughs and neighbourhoods. And I think what we're really seeing in London is the creation of ecosystems. Whether it be Old Street in a tech sector, or whether it be the Crick Institute at King's Cross, or Imperial College at White City. These are areas where groups of specialised companies and individuals come together. As TP was saying, you know, they are, there's knowledge spillover, they're creating new products and ideas. They're places with real purpose. And I can just see London and other places in the UK. I think the future for us, especially post-Brexit, is that we really focus on these ecosystems, places with real purpose, where we share resources, share expertise to create the new products of the future. And I think that's a really exciting time. And I think, in a way, COVID has accelerated digitalization, accelerated people's desire to collaborate. And hopefully that'll have a knock-on effect on productivity.
Thank you very much. So I wanted to ask you all now about the definition of productivity, because it feels like there are layers of definition of that. You know, productivity can be sort of very straightforward, you know, how productive is the workforce? And there was a mention earlier of, you know, people seeing it as an individual choice in terms of how they work and flexibility versus needing to think about it more from the perspective of the business. So you've got individual, you've got business productivity, then you've got sort of areas of a city, the productivity and how well that's connected, and then you've got the city as a whole, and then you've got your global network of cities. I mean, it does sort of go on and on a bit, really. I think the question I'm trying to ask, and I'm getting there in a very roundabout way, is there a bit of a tunnel vision when it comes to talking about productivity? When we talk about it, is the industry maybe talking about it on a bit of a one-dimensional basis? And are we talking about it too much in terms of how productive is a business or how productive is an office? And I'm going to come to you, Tripti, on this first, then I'm going to go to Stephen and then to Piers, just to get everybody's thoughts on whether or not we have a broad enough definition of productivity when we're talking about it in relation to a city. Tripti, good luck with that.
Well, are we talking about the city or the industry? Because I can tell you the industry doesn't define productivity at all.
Let's start there. I think that's a good place to start.
I think with real estate, firstly, it's very large and it has different sectors which all have different ideas of productivity. But if you really look at like the basic definition, the measure of productivity is primarily the amount of value add output based on the number of labor hours, and that's where it becomes a bit problematic because you're sometimes talking of it as labor hours. Now, there's a few things that can apply to it. And like I said, you're always looking at the value add. Now, if your value add is massive for very little hours put in, your productivity is going to be very high. Now, real estate usually does not fit that category because even though it has a fairly high value add, if you look at from, say, a development perspective, that is fairly high. However, the number of people that are involved in the profession are fairly large and the number of labor hours that are actually put in are fairly large, which is why you see in real estate, people are not paid like bankers because their productivity level is lower. But what that means is the minute your productivity level goes up, you're also now depending on a smaller group of people. You're looking at people who are very well paid, who do very good work from a perspective of the amount of unit economic value that they bring either to an organization or to a city. Now, this is, I know I keep harping on taxation, but there's a reason why after a certain point, individuals, especially in the UK, kind of reach their threshold of satisfaction. Because after a certain threshold, what's the point of working that hard? Because half of it is anyways going towards, you know, your taxes, your personal taxes. Now, with work from home, et cetera, coming in, you're taking expenses from a business and passing that to an individual. So my office expense, which otherwise sits in my balance sheet, has suddenly been moved to my individual employee, who is now willing to take over that £500 a month desk space, which I used to, you know, load onto them and then actually deduct against our taxes in a company, is now actually going against an expense that's non-deductible for an employee. So if we look at it from a productivity discussion, we need to then wonder, what do we actually want people to be productive about? If at the end of the day, it's about the amount of output that's coming out of the economy in general, we then need to incentivize the individual, not the business. And that's not happening. So whether it's real estate or the city, eventually we're coming into a very macroeconomic perspective, really. And anything we say about the pubs are opening up to work from home, so you can sit in the pub and work, all that's fine. But I think our biggest concern right now is that nobody knows from a macroeconomic perspective how this is going to play out for the individual or the enterprise, and does the city.
Thank you very much. Stephen, your thoughts on that, either on what Tripti was just saying there or on the question in general?
I think if Tripti answered it on a kind of high macro level, I'll go to the asset and kind of the industry level. I think, as I said before, I'm not sure we can tell people how they can be best productive. I think that's a decision they need to make for themselves. But you know, at a real estate asset level, I don't think we're very good at judging if the product we create actually supports productivity in workers. And I think we need to somehow use data and technology to collect, to be able to make better decisions on that. So yeah, I think somebody, doesn't really matter who, whether it's the landlord or the tenant, should really be collecting the data on how space is being used, the quality, the environmental quality of that space, and making sure that does support kind of a productive workforce.
Thank you very much. And Piers, your thoughts on that definition of productivity?
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. I think this goes back to our conversation around people flourishing. I think it's it's well known that the flourishing index for people in the UK, I think something like less than 10% of young people in the UK feel they're flourishing. And if you compare that to Denmark, I think 40% of young people feel they're flourishing. So one of the elements that we've been working with Manchester University is a flourishing index, so that we're able to actually, Stephen's point, actually measure people's well-being, because that's directly linked to their happiness and their productivity. And, you know, I think this is really interesting times, and I think people are now taking sustainability and their health and well-being to write up the priority list. And I think this will allow us to monitor people's well-being and productivity, and hope make the necessary changes. From a developer's point of view, monitor designs, working with architects and scientists to understand how we can create more neighborly social values, equality, and ultimately flourishing neighborhoods, so that people do feel happier and more productive.
Thank you very much. We've got a couple of minutes left, and what I always like to do is just get sort of a final message from everybody on what we've discussed and what the sort of headline would be if you wanted our viewers and listeners to log off from discussion thinking one thing, or with one thing lodged in their heads for the rest of the day, and hopefully maybe even here. What would that be? And Piers, that's...
Hi there. I think for me, yes, we're at a challenging time, but this, during challenging times, there's periods of great innovation, and there is an opportunity to do things differently. And I think the real focus now, as an individual and as organizations, will be the importance of collaborating, co-locating new ideas. I think there's a focus on health and well-being, which is good for everyone, and improved productivity. And I think we all appreciate now the importance of sustainability, both in terms of commuting, the buildings we occupy. All of these things are under review, and that's a good thing.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Stephen, same question to you.
Let's make sure we use this opportunity to really listen to the individual, to give people the workspace, whatever that may be. Like I said, could be an office, could be home, could be somewhere in between. But make sure that really supports them in them being able to be productive. And then on a city level, I think, you know, let's make sure we continue trying to make London as sustainable as possible, and also trying to increase the affordability of living and working in the city.
Thank you. And finally, Tripti.
Yeah, I think I'll agree on the part about affordability and the consumer behavior is something that should be a major takeaway from coronavirus. I think we may be looking at a slightly extreme period right now, which is it's a quick lesson in what the future has to hold. So I don't necessarily think that this is a period for us to react to, but actually a period for us to learn from. And I think that's really important. The fact that the consumer may become your eventual client is something that real estate is still coming to grapple with. I think the bigger concern, which real estate also needs to grapple with, is that there is a lot of social inequality that is being exposed during this period. And whether it's by the increase in productivity, the use of technology, or just the loss of certain industries, there will be a lot of people who will not have the life that we have always had for the past, say, at least 30 years. And they are, in fact, an entire market in themselves. And unless they're catered to in a very sensitive way, they will actually end up becoming the other half. And you don't want to alienate society, especially as you're building cities. So I would say the big takeaways have to be understanding the consumer, as well as the social problems that we very often neglect as real estate businesses.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. I always love the final thoughts. You always get some really good gems to add onto the conversation at the end there. Thank you so much to our panel, to Piers, to Stephen and to Tripti for joining today. And thank you to everybody who's tuned in for this Future of London session. Thank you very much.
Draw, Poleg, they're full of words of wisdom as always. Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Future of London podcast. We hope you found the content helpful. If you'd like more of the same and to keep up with all the latest news, views, analysis and research that the EG Group has to provide, be sure to sign up to all of our podcasts and subscribe to Radius Data Exchange for unlimited access to all of our content and comprehensive commercial real estate data.